Accession number 32369, Reel 7.
Mr. Cassidy, Reel 7. So you arrived in Berlin. Do you remember the exact date that you actually arrived there?
No. But, I remember it was... it seemed a long time to be in an aeroplane. It was the first time I'd been in one. And from Newcastle to... I believe it was Tempelhof Airport, something like that, that we probably landed in. And then... we were taken, as I say, up to this barracks on the outskirts of Berlin, Montgomery Barracks. This was a massive configuration of buildings and squares and football fields and everything all in one. It was like a little town in itself. And... and of course, by that time, by the time we're getting ourselves in there and sorted out, we didn't know anybody really, except who we'd travelled over with. And people were coming and looking at you, you know, where you're from, and, oh, you just finished training, oh, you'll soon get into the routine of things. And we're giving advice on what not to do, what to do, and who to mix with, what no, who not to mix with, and then the rigmarole of getting new kit again started and going through the quartermasters for bedding, where we'd sleep, our company, and a bit of the routine, what we're expected to do and things like that. Oh, you finished training now, you don't do that. You know, this, you've got to be a lot better than that, you know, if you want to get on here and different things. And then, of course, Berlin.
Can we, before going, which company were you joining?
I joined C Company. Mm-hmm. C Company, and I joined as an ordinary rifleman in C Company. And...
can we talk a little bit about the company that you were joining, a commanding officer and...
The commanding officer at that time, I think, was a Major Grosch. And...
what was he like?
He was a very... he reminded me of a country gentleman with a moustache. And the main fella who stood out to me again was the RSM. And his RSM was a man called Spud Taylor, and he ruled the roost on everything that happened at Montgomery Barracks. And he was a man who we later found out who we respected, but at the same time we didn't get on the wrong side of Spud Taylor. So there were so many different characters in the battalion, in the company, you know, it was unbelievable. Each one had stories to tell of you know, what they did and where they'd been. And we met the Jim Murrays of this world, and who had been involved in active service, you know, abroad, and all been all over the world. And we would sit in on a night time in the Nuffy, and stories would banter about people who had been to Hong Kong and places like that. And then, of course, it would switch to Germany and the war and what had happened, and in Berlin. And, of course, we found out that there were certain places in Berlin where we weren't allowed to go. And, of course, these were the places where everybody wanted to go, because if they were out of bounds to troops, there must be something in there going on that we should find out. So these bars in Berlin, when we went down and found out, everyone would make a beeline to the ones that were out of bounds to find out why they were put out of bounds. And of course it wasn't long before people found out it was either through the girls involved in there, or because there were so many fights it was unbelievable. But where our barracks were in Berlin anyway, a place called Kladow, there was only one bar there anyway called Willie's Bar, civilian wise, and that would get a lot of the lads from the barracks going there before they went down into Berlin itself. They would call it Willie's Bar and get themselves tanked up with drink then. It was a bit cheaper there before they went down to Berlin. But of course, all the other things that were happening around the camp at that time was this Berlin Wall. And with this being so young, it took me a bit to really, you know, think about it and find out why would somebody build a wall around a city, you know? And then we were given lectures and told the who's and the what shouldn't do, why it's been done and why it was wrong, and what we would be expected to do in, you know, in the future about it. And of course we were right on the spot, because the Russians, although they'd built a fence right round our camp, that was part of the Berlin Wall as well, because the Russian perimeter had a barbed wire fence and had ringed it right round on the outskirts of Montgomery Barracks, and we could walk right up to them and see the Russians behind it, you know. And of course there was a bit of taunting going on, and we were told in no uncertain manner to keep away from them and not to converse with them or anything like that. And we said we were trained then on what would happen when we got down to the real wall at the Brandenburg Gate and the Russian War Memorial, where most of our duties were going to take place. And then our eyes were really open then, because it was a really on-site experience where you were in the public eye 24 hours a day, because with being so new, there was people coming from all around the world to have a look at this Berlin Wall. And there was also the German people who whole families had been cut off. They had families over the other side of the wall, and they were waving to each other. And they had the East German guards on one side stopping people getting anywhere near it, and we were on the other side watching them. And then there was the odd skirmishes.
Did you see any people attempting to break?
Yeah, when we were on patrol a few times, the radio would be on that there was an escape being attempted either in on the River Havel. There was a part of the divide and perimeter was this river as well, and a few of them had tried to swim across to the west side, and of course some of them didn't make it anywhere. But there was always different attempts being made to get across the wall. And although some of the times we weren't there, we did finally hear about it, you know, about them coming through, smashing through the barriers with cars, and being hidden in cars when they've come through from the other side, and the tunnelling as well, and things like that. So, I mean, it was a period of where there was something happening every day of the week. And of course, when we were on guard there, and also the Russian War Memorial, where the Russians were behind barbed wire guarding their memorial, I often wondered when we were on guard, are we to stop people getting at the Russians, or to stop the Russians getting out at us, or what? And where the Brandenburg Gate is, of course, there's a great big massive road, straight road, and during the day there was a continual stream of continental buses coming down each side with tourists on, looking at us and looking at the wall and taking photos. And then they would stop and come over and speak in all these foreign languages and ask, can we have your photo taken against this, and can we have your photo taken? And of course, with us being so young, I mean, this was absolutely heaven for us, you know. We were really enjoyed this sort of game, and it was the only time when the rotors went up for guard duty, I think we got volunteers. They said, "Well, I'll go on the Rotor Warm as guard duty or the gate, the Brandenburg gate, and do your duties next week if you want." But of course, the guard duties at the camp had to be done as well, and they all weren't very, very good. We didn't like them. But Berlin, very big city and something brand new to us, and certainly so, you opened our eyes up.
So the first feelings that you got of Berlin were one of excitement, presumably.
Yeah, of course it was. And then as we grew into it, we started reading books about the Second World War and Hitler and where he was, where his cellar was and where he camped up, and then we could actually go down to the Brandenburg Gate and see where the Reichstag was and places like that, and say, well, you know, we're standing on a bit of history here. And it was only then, really, you know, that we began to accumulate all this material about what had happened in the Second World War and how the Russians had gotten themselves in a position of getting the best slice of the cake, and what the Americans were doing there, what the French were doing there, and what the British were doing there, you know. So it was, we were then avidly reading books and watching films about the Second World War. And even then, it wasn't until we'd been there a few months before we suddenly realised how close the extermination camps were to Berlin. And we always said, well, you know, one day we might get the chance to go and visit them. And, of course, in the 60s, a lot of rebuilding was happening in Berlin, but a lot of the war damage still was visible, you know. And it was just a bit of history that we were part of.
What was your first impressions of the Germans, the German people?
Well, we couldn't understand them. I mean, our language was, we've learned how to ask for a beer and how to ask for a ticket on the tram for to get to Berlin from camp, and how to get back again, and the taxi drivers. Most of them did speak a bit English, and we always took them, the Germans, as being a bit big-headed. Didn't like the British because the British beat them in the war. And beware of them and don't trust them. That was our lack of the Germans. And of course, we had Germans working for us in the camps, you know. They worked in the canteen and in the Naffy. The barbers were all Germans and things like that. So probably we would say there's good Germans and bad Germans. But the majority were bad Germans, you know. We didn't really get on. But there were invites from German people for the soldiers, for anyone who wanted to go and spend a weekend with a German family.
Did that happen?
I never volunteered for that. If it had been in a group or something like that, I probably would have, but I was a bit wary on going with a German family for a full weekend, you know, on my own. Especially, I was a bit put back because I knew I couldn't speak the language, and if they couldn't speak the language, didn't understand us, it wasn't going to be a very nice weekend anyway. But I never took that off. Some did and enjoyed it, and others came back with tales of, well, we, you know, it was all right, and I didn't like what we were eating, and I did, there were a lot of smoking of cigars and drinking and things like that. I said, well, that's not really for me anyway, so I didn't volunteer for it.
Can you describe Montgomery Barracks, particularly comparing it with barracks that you'd experienced at home?
Well, it was really modern for its time, with the prominent feature being the gatehouse as you went in, and the guard room. A massive guard room and a gatehouse. Of course, with the big mirrors there, where you would look at yourself before you went out or when you came back in again. And there was also a married quarters in there, which we hadn't seen much of when we'd been in training at Pontefract. And officers' quarters, but they were grey, big grey buildings, modern for its time, you know. And the barracks, as I say, were spread out over a massive area. It had a really big cook house, a big naffy, and it also had a few shops in it as well. And of course, the big thing it had there, it had its own cinema. Mm. And this was good to us because, you know, there were some good films coming out at the time. But the main thing on there, and I always remember the first... the first Christmas being over there was we got a visit from Dusty Springfield, who was really big at that time, 61, who went out at 62, and she'd was visiting the area and she wanted to come and see the British troops. So they arranged for her to come to Montgomery Barracks and put a show on for us in this little cinema that we had above the MT block. And she was she was something stunning, really, you know. She was with a group and she was singing all the songs at the time that were hits, and she stopped there for 2 or 3 days in the sergeant's mess and then the officer's mess. So the funny thing was, I often think, well, you know, I spoke to her, I got an autograph, but I don't know what happened to any of the programmes or anything like that of them days, which probably if I had kept, there would have been worth a bit of money these days, you know. And but that was one of the big things that had happened then. But at the same time, when I think back of it, there was always personalities coming and visiting Berlin because of the diplomatic scene and things that were happening there at the time. The one thing I did volunteer was that every now and again there was a patrol that went were allowed to go into East Germany, and you were allowed to go in, provided you went in an army Land Rover and you didn't stop. You put your name down and said if you wanted a trip into East Germany, you could have a chance to go there. And it was always on a night time, during the night, I don't know why. But anyway, I went down and I went there and just saw how different it was on the other side of the wall. Everything was painted dull and everything. So, you know, life was just completely different over that side to where it was in the Western world then.
And did the Russians allow you through for that?
Yeah, they did. I mean, there was a lot of checking of credentials and who was in there, and you had to get out at one stage, and they would look at your ID card against you know, to make sure you were the same one. I mean, they didn't see anything or anything, but they they could hold you for, sometimes they would hold you for quite a while before they let you through. And also when you came back as well, the Land Rover was searched and you were searched as well. And if they were in a bad mood, they would take the time doing it.
And was there any purpose in this? Was it just literally a...
Well, at that time there were things happening, i.e. where the new... There was a lot of East Germans trying to get to West Germany over the wall, and they would try every trick in the book for to do it. And the Russians wouldn't trust anybody at all on helping them. And they always thought that, well, if they could get through, perhaps we'd kind of stop them patrols over here, but by gum, we'll make sure that they don't bring anybody back with them that they shouldn't do as well. And probably some of the British patrols were stopped over there and said, you know, can you hide us in the back or in the boot or something like that and take us back there? But I don't know, it was another thing. We were mainly, our main contact with the Russians were when we were on the guard duty overnight, and the big thing was we got to know the Russians as well on their guard duty. And we would exchange cap badges. The badges was the big thing. The Russians always wanted watches, and they would give you cap badges and sometimes caps in exchange for watches. And and different things like that. The law was against the rules and everything, and we were told not to fraternize with the Russians. It went on, you know. And I mean, there was some times where somebody would, you know, hold up a cap badge for the swap, and the Russians would come down and, yeah, what do you want? And by communicating by sign language, they would take the cap badge, but you wouldn't see them again, you know. But that was few and far between. On the whole, they would, you know, say to you, have you got a watch? And say, you want a hat? And give you a hat for a watch? And that went on. And
can you take me through a typical day? How long were you with Sea Conroy? Because I think you went into signals, didn't you?
I went into the mortar platoon.
Oh, mortar platoon, right. So how long had you been with Sea Company before that happened?
A very short time. We did a bit weapon training for with Sea Company only for maybe 3 months. And then found out that there was transfers required for mortar platoon and anti-tank platoon. But you had to be of a certain grade for to do it, and all that. So I said, well, I fancy the mortars, I've seen them, and I've seen the damage they do, I like them. And I know they get around, they're pretty mobile, you know. So I put me in down there, and you went on a selection introduction, and I had an interview with a mortar platoon officer at the time, and I got picked. So it was although the mortar platoon was attached to C Company, they later became a company on their own. So we had two mortar detachments in C Company, and we were using these 3-inch mortars at the time. And we thought we were a bit higher echelon than what the normal rifleman was really then, and of course we were, in as much as that we were left on our, well, not on our own, but we had a platoon sergeant and a platoon officer who would you know, more or less excuse us from a few duties if there were guard duties and things like that, if we had some things to do with the mortar platoon.
Can you take me through the platoon structure? You say you had an officer.
An officer, we had a platoon sergeant.
Who was the officer?
I think at the time it was a man called Pyle. And I've never seen him since then. P-Y-L-E, Mr. Pyle.
Remember anything about him? Was he okay?
Yes, he was great. And it was then that I met my old friend Mike Sumner again, because he was the officer in charge of the anti-tanks. Now, the anti-tanks were something different. They were then using a thing called a Morbat, which was pulled by a German truck called a Unimog on the back. And it's the barrel was like hitched onto the trailer bar at the back of the Unimog, and it had two tyres on and all the infrastructure at the back of it. So these were the anti-tank platoon, and when I first, that was some weapon, that was when it went off. And there was a lad called Johnny Cregan, who he was a corporal at the time. He was in charge of one of these guns, and eventually, when we did go to fire them, the mortars and the anti-tanks, I realised just what sort of velocity these anti-tanks had when they went off, because without any warning, they would suddenly unleash a round, which was an eardrum splitting sound, and really shook you to your roots as well. But Johnny Cregan was the bloke. He was very good at his job, and he knew the anti-tank gun right from, you know, from beginning to end. There wasn't a thing you could tell him about it, and also the damage it could do.
So you had a platoon officer, then you said you had a sergeant.
A sergeant, we had two corporals.
Do you remember names of these people?
Ben Halliwell was
what they were like?
One of the sergeants, Benny Halliwell. He was a well-known figure in in the mortars at the time. He had a big handlebar moustache and was a good drinker, Ben Halliwell was. And he went up and down in the ranks like I don't know what. One moment he would be a corporal, the next minute he'd be reduced to the ranks because of drinking and drunk and things like that. And then next minute he'd be back up to Lance Corporal, then Corporal, and then he became Sergeant. So him and another lad called Dave Scott, who was a corporal at the time, they were both drinking pals, and the amount of ale they could shift was nobody's business. But they always seemed to manage to get on parade with the mortars and train us and whatever. And we had to travel to a place called, I think it was Putlos, to fire our first live rounds with a 3-inch mortar.
Can we just finish the structure off first? So you got a sergeant, two corporals, I think you said.
Yeah. And two lance corporals.
Yeah. Two lance corporals.
And each crew on the 3-inch mortar was three people. You had a number one, a number two, and a number three.
And how many mortars per section?
There would be two mortars per company.
Per company?
Yeah, two mortars per company.
So the mortars was raised out to the companies?
Yes, there were six in total to the three companies in the battalion. And as I said, now and again, the six of us would get together sometimes for training and sometimes for exercise as well. But that was few and far between. Most of the training, as I say, was done company-wise in pairs, you know, with the two mortars that we had for each company.
So a 3-inch mortar is quite a size and weight.
Yeah, it is. And it was times when we had to devise our own methods of transporting them as well. We didn't have Land Rovers all the time, and we devised there wasn't a set down pack for packing the 3-inch mortar to go on a route march, or if you had to carry it, it was left to our own devices. So it was mainly a case of the barrel would come out and it would be put straddled over the pack of somebody. The base plate, which was they were all heavy, you know, steel parts, they were strapped to the backpack as well. And then there was the tripod itself, which was a mixture of legs and turning handles and things like that on it, which was most awkward of the lot. And again, that would have to be strapped as well. And then when we thought of it, there was also the company were allocated so many rounds that they would have to provide and carry the ammunition if there was no transport available. But of course, most of the time we had two Land Rovers, where the each section or mortar platoon would fit into, and the mortar would be straddled under the Land Rover itself. So we did a lot of training in, I think it was the Grunewald and places like that, with the mortars on the Land Rovers, and of course we would be sitting in the back, which was great as well. Could see all the rest of them walking.
Was this the same weapon as the Second World War 3-inch mortar?
Yeah, they had it in the Second World War. Yep, the 3-inch mortar was then. And
so
we
a well-trained war mortar team, what kind of speed of fire could they put up?
Well, we were trained at the time. I mean, we could, from nothing, we could be mobilised from a Land Rover with nothing there, and have the 3-inch mortar in a firing position within a minute. That from hearing of if there was a target identified from a radio call coming in, and that would be sighting the mortar from the grid references given, sighting them up and getting preparing the ammunition ready for the fire within a minute. And as the teams, the three members of the team were knitted together, the faster they became. And it wasn't a case of there was better number ones, obviously, than number twos, but we would move round, you know. We each will learn to
know each other's
role. And
so you knew the whole job at the end of the day.
And
so what was the way the duties were split then? You say number one, two, three, what exactly
the number
did each
one
man do?
Yeah, well, the number one would be the sight layer. he would put the sight on the 3-inch mortar and arrange the barrel to be at the correct elevation to fire the round at the target. The number two mainly was there to check the ammunition, the round, and he would place the round into the barrel and release it there. The number three would be mainly preparing the ammunition to the different types of head that you could put on the rounds, i.e. smoke or phosphorus, things like that. There was a numerous range of different rounds that you could fire at that time with a 3-inch mortar. And you worked in harmony, a team as well. But of course, at that time, we didn't have ear defenders and things like that. So after you'd been firing live rounds, after a while, you got back. And I often wonder why, how, and I realise how people's eardrums were perforated.